Okay, I just want to start for 1 minute and tell you about my friend that I told you about last week who was dying, who's now dead. So sad to hear. His name is, maybe some of you might know him, Ari Orlando O'Leary.
Yeah, good friend of mine.
Yeah, so he passed away.
I know.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you a question. I wanted to make a donation to whoever's making
Right. I think the yeshiva is going to arrange a full kaddish for him, and Howard Hoffman is also saying kaddish for him. Mm-hmm. And then we're also taking on whoever wants to learn Mishnah in his memory. We're going to try to divide up the entire Mishnah and learn it by his first yahrzeit. Mishnah has the same letters as neshama, soul. So it is a custom to learn Mishnahs to elevate the soul of the departed.
And they do the, I just heard that they do the Mishnah on the Erev Yom Tov, so that they celebrate it in shul.
They do certain Mishnahs according to each yontif, right? But you can learn the entire Mishnah. There's six orders of the Mishnah to learn the entire thing. Right. So you divide it up among people. Mm. Like each person takes a different, however much they can, tractate or whatever, and makes a commitment to learn it by his yahrzeit. So if anybody wants to do that. But I just wanted to tell you two things, just because it's so interesting how life works. This, if he would have had somebody to sit Shiva for him, this would have been his last day of Shiva. But he doesn't, so there's not. But one of the things I noticed about Shiva is that it really helps with the longevity of the person, because it takes stories out of that person, out of their life, into the people who are there, who come to visit the people who are sitting Shiva, so that people hear a little bit. So I figured, there's no Shiva, but you could hear just a story or two, so that you have something that you can be inspired by his life. So he was a brilliant person. And one of his classic things was he would always say, well, when were you born? And you'd say your birthday, February 8th, 1964. And he'd say, oh, that was a Saturday. So I asked him, how do you do that? I thought it was a mathematical formula. And it wasn't. I mean, it was amazing. He would say, well, I remember that February 4th, 1963 was the first day that I bought a brown sweatshirt, and my mother commented on it, and that was a Tuesday. And so if you just add 364 days, and you take away one day for the leap year, and then you add a month onto that, and then you get to, of course, it was a Saturday. And he could do that for everybody's birthday all the time, when he enlisted in the Army, or when his mother moved to Colorado, or whatever it was. Like, he knew.
And he'd remember your birthday.
And he remembered it exactly, always, always. He always remembered what you're up to. He was a brilliant guy. He spoke five languages. He was half Navajo, half Mexican. And he's raised in a Catholic family. So his mother, when he was a little boy, I think I told you this, right, taught him the secret prayer. So this is a secret prayer that you only ever say if you think you're going to die, but it's very bad luck to say it in public, ever. Nobody should ever, ever hear you say it, because it's very, very bad luck. And that prayer was, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. So when he was in his early 20s, he heard somebody say the secret prayer out loud. And he went over to them and said, how could you even say such a prayer out loud? Like, how did you do that? And they're like, secret prayer? That's not a secret prayer. That's the Shema. And he said, the Shema? How do you know it? He said, that's like the Jewish mantra. We all say, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. So he learned that maybe there's some kind of Jewish connection in his family. And then so he did end up converting. He had to, even though his mother taught it to him in Hebrew, still there wasn't a clear maternal line from, let's say, the Spanish expulsion until now. And apparently for many of the Jews during the Spanish expulsion, they did behave Catholic on the outside, Jewish on the inside for a few generations. But as they became more and more distant, the Jewish practices became more enigmatic. But one thing that happened was actually keeping it secret became a religious act. So the act of just maintaining the secrecy was important. And so it wasn't really until now, in the age of the internet, that more crypto-Jews are coming to realize that there is a community of them if they would just know, because keeping it secret was so important. And so they did keep it secret, and only now we're in the privacy of their own homes, they can do some research, they can realize that they don't have to keep it secret anymore. That's not actually a religious thing to do, to keep it secret, and people are starting to connect and see their family histories. So it was interesting during this whole week that I spent in the hospital with him and his Catholic family, his nieces and nephews, who are in their 50s. So they said, oh, you know, he chose to be Jewish, but we could never do that. We love pork. We eat so much pork. Our family eats pork and everything. Pork, pork, pork. I said, not like his family that came from a place in New Mexico where they mostly ate lamb. And I thought, that's interesting. There's a place in New Mexico where they mostly eat lamb, or is it because that's a non-pork eating family? So even though they're a Catholic. So they didn't even put everything together. So it's just interesting to see. And his quest in his life, I mean, he, in a way, he spoke Japanese, he spoke a little Chinese, he spoke some French and Spanish and English and Hebrew. He had all of Hamlet memorized. He had an excellent memory, excellent. Kohelet and Hebrew memorized. Like, he was an amazing guy. So,
What age did he pass?
74. He had a massive stroke. Mm-hmm. And he just, he decided he couldn't swallow anymore. So he decided to not get a tube in his stomach for nutrition. And so the doctor came in and explained to him, you know, what will happen if you refuse nutrition and fluids, what the course will be. And he said, are you a doctor? He couldn't really, even without half a brain, he was still really smart. And he couldn't talk so clearly, but he said, you're a doctor, right? He said, yes, I am. He said, you have a devastating grasp on the obvious.
So. Yeah, well, he had a bad respiratory problem.
He did. Years. He did, yeah. Yeah. So, anyway, he was a special guy. And one way that's interesting to see, I think I mentioned in this class, which group was it? Oh, the Shomronim, the Samaritans. The Talmud said that the Samaritans made more kosher matzah than the Jews. They kept mitzvahs better than some of the Jews. And that's how you knew they weren't actually Jewish, because Jews are very complicated and they have a very complicated relationship with Judaism and they don't always do things right. And Jews who are doing everything right, you have to question, are they actually Jewish or not? Because their relationships are quite complicated. So that's like one way you could see maybe his lineage was, you know, straight through, because his relationship was very Jewish with Judaism, in and out. And but he loved it. He loved it, and he wove in and out of observance, but he davened every day at the Alliance, and he volunteered for so many people. He sat Shmira for them after they died. So there were so many people that he would lovingly refer to. I'd mention somebody's name, and he'd say, oh, I remember Clara. I sat Shmira for her. You know, he just had this loving relationship with so many different people throughout the community. So, just wanted to start.
He didn't have a descendant that was Jewish?
He didn't have a Jewish descendant, right.
That's what, and so nobody could do it for him, even.
So there is a question about that.
Somehow?
I would like to look more into that, because there is a question about Shiva and converts. So a convert like me can choose if they want to sit Shiva for their parents, since I'm the Jewish one and I can choose my relationship with them if I want to do that or not. But then the question would be, I have a friend who's a convert who converted in her late 60s, now 72, so her children are grown and not Jewish. So could somebody sit Shiva for her? Mm. So apparently the soul of the deceased also is in the Shiva home. And when one pays a Shiva call, they are also comforting the departed soul, because it's not so easy for the soul to leave. Right? So the soul also, there is some still, you're still tied in to the world somehow, and the people that you miss, you still, there is a departure process. So the soul is in the house. And I learned that when I paid a Shiva call on an only child, whose both parents were gone. The mother had just passed away, and she was actually alone in the Shiva house when I went. So since my Hebrew is fluent, instead of saying the regular Hamakom Yinechem Etchem B'toch Sharev Leitzion Yerushalayim, I switched it to the singular feminine, Hamakom Yinechem Otach B'toch Sharev Leitzion Yerushalayim. And she said, oh no, you actually say it in the plural, because you're comforting not just me, who's sitting here alone, but also the soul. So you say it in the plural. So I learned from that you're comforting the soul. So what I have learned is that the soul does dwell around their home during that week. And so somebody could sit there, not exactly Shiva, so I want to learn more of the halachas, how somebody could do that, especially for this other friend that I have.
How about sitting after, when he's in for the 24 hours?
Sitting Shmira, somebody sits Shmira to watch the, to guard the body. For sure somebody does that. And that doesn't have to be relative, and it's not relative dependent. But Shiva is for the living, but also there is an element, it seems, for the deceased. So somebody can sit in the home and so I'm not exactly sure, do they receive people and talk about that person, or just sit there to comfort the soul that's hovering for that week before it departs to the next level? But there are levels of withdrawal that a soul goes through, and so there is that first week for the soul as well. And so the same, it parallels the stages of the mourning. So for the mourner, the child of the deceased, or the close relative. There's the first period, which is called aninut, or aninus. That's from the death until the burial. So that's the first, most intense stage, before the dead is buried. And during that stage, one can't do any positive commandments. No brachas on food, or after you go to the bathroom, or putting on tefillin, or davening, nothing. You just sit. You can't transgress. You can't eat treif. But you don't make a bracha on anything, or do anything positive. You can't give tzedakah. Like, no positive commandments during that time. Then comes Shiva, the 7 days, so that's from burial till 7 days later. Then comes the Shloshim, 30 days, so that's from the 7th day until the 30th. And then comes the whole year of mourning for siblings. It's over at this point. This is only for parents that there's the whole year, but still there's the whole year for all the souls. So then comes that year. And then, just ignore that. Sorry, I forgot to turn that up. Yeah, I'm trying to make a quiet tune. Go away. So at the end of that first year, then there's an additional elevation. Why isn't it turning off? It's a new phone. I'm still learning how to use it. Oh, turn off. Okay, good. So then it elevates even further. So during, and there's different accessibility to that person's soul during that time. And it does apparently hover around the grave after the Shiva, especially for the first year, but even for subsequent years, which is why people visit graves. And there is a custom to go to the grave of a parent, certainly, to invite them for a major celebration, a wedding of a child or something like that.
Not before Pesach or anything, right? But only before, like...
Before Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur.
Right.
Yeah. Because Yom Kippur...
Also on the anniversary of their...
Of their death. But Yom Kippur is called Yom HaKippurim, which is plural. Yom Kippur, we call it Yom Kippur, but also Yom HaKippurim. In the plural, because it atones for the sins of the living and for the sins of the dead. So there is a concept to visit the grave before Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, before Yom Tov time, because that is a time of judgment. Rosh Hashanah is judgment for the whole world, living and dead. And Yom Kippur is atonement for the whole world, living and dead. So, all those things with souls.
Well, for siblings, it's only 30 days.
For siblings, you only mourn. The mourner only mourns for 30 days, right? For siblings and spouses.
Right.
And spouses and children. Right. Right. So there's seven.
11 months.
Right. Correct. Right. Right. So there's seven relatives that we mourn, meaning have halachas about mourning. And that's father, mother, father, mother, sister, brother, son, daughter, spouse are the seven. So it's only for father and mother that we have the whole year of mourning, which is really 11 months. Or we say Kaddish for 11 months, I think we mourn for the whole year, the halachas of mourning. And then for the other ones, we just mourn for 30 days. So, of course, you can mourn as long as you want, but I mean the halachas of mourning, the law, the legal framework for the mourning is for 30 days for the other ones and a year for the parents. Okay, let's move on to history. So this is what I'd like to do today. You're not picking up. Today we're going to get to the end of the Second Temple, and I'm going to do it very fast because you are not picking up from here next semester. So what I want to do is a whole history review, which will be a little bit of a peek into the future too, but just do a whole timeline from creation until right now. And that's going to take at least a half an hour. So I want to do this in shorter. So we're going to start with this piece of paper. So I believe that we left off with the Tsukim and the Prushim, the Sadducees and the Pharisees. Just a few comments on the, it's not on your paper, because I did have him in the hospital for the whole last week, and then he died, and then I left on a trip, and I didn't get back until Friday when I made Shabbos, and then kids, and then today, and so this is how much preparation you get. So, sorry. I did listen to lots of tapes, but I didn't get it all nicely organized for you. Okay. So the Sadducees and the Pharisees, one point I just want to clarify here. So we are descendants of the Pharisees. Rabbinic Judaism today is a Pharisaic religion. In Christianity, Pharisees are bad. In Judaism, Pharisees are good. Important to understand. The Sadducees denied the oral law. So here are some key points for the Sadducees. They said no oral law. They said no immortality of the soul. If there's no immortality of the soul, you don't have Judaism altogether. Judaism as a system can't function without the concept of immortality of the soul. So, because then there's no reward and punishment, there's no next world, there's no justice really for anything, because you can't mete out justice without a next world. How could you ever have justice? We do have a principle of justice. How could you bring Hitler to justice in this world? You can't make one person suffer as much as he caused people to suffer. Right? I see people still suffering today from Hitler. I have people who live in my neighborhood where they are grandchildren, great-grandchildren of survivors. And I see the great-grandchildren of survivors who are young today, under 10, but they are still affected. I can see the effect. I can see it because I know the children. I don't know the survivors, but I know the children of the survivors who are in their early 60s, and I know their children who are in their 30s, and I know their children who are 10 and under, and I definitely see an emotional thwarting and relationship, a difficulty and a complication in parenting and emotional closeness and distance and closeness and distance and, you know, just a total mess up because of the war. It's very clear. So in some families it's more clear and in some families it's not. But sometimes when I look at one of the children and I just think, you know, like that's those nightmares, that anxiety, that whatever it is, that son who acts girly according to the father who wants to smack him around and have him be like a man, that's all Hitler reaching into this generation and a stranglehold on those children and messing up their emotional lives. It's definitely there. So it's very sad, but I definitely see it. No question about it. It's definitely there. So you can't cause one human being in this world to suffer enough to pay back everything that he caused. So there has to be a framework in which justice can be had, and that's in the next world. There is suffering for somebody like that in the next world until it's paid. So that's a lot of suffering. And then at the end of that, a soul like that is obliterated. They don't get to just close their eyes, though, at death and be gone. They first suffer until it's paid, and then they're gone. They don't get eternal life. But they get suffering until it's done.
What makes it paid? What does it take?
God exacts that retribution. I mean, that's one of the things that Ari used to say. He was a Marine. He said that the Marine creed was kill them all and let God sort them out. So, kill them all and let God sort them out. That's what the Marines did. So, he was in Vietnam. Korea. He was in Korea, right? Yeah, Korea. So, but basically, we don't, as Jews, we don't believe in kill them all, let God sort them out, but we definitely understand God will sort them out. We don't, and that's one reason why we don't have to, we can actually separate ourselves from judgment sometimes. We certainly have to make judgment on people. Should we be in relationship with them or not? Should we invest with them or not? Should we marry into their family or not? Should we be friends with them or not? But we don't have to necessarily, we don't have to judge somebody else. That's God's job, and he'll do it. We don't have to worry about it. So we can step back from that and just totally let go of judgment. Not up to us. We can just be the kind people that we should be and work on ourselves and let God take care of them. So immortality of the soul is a very important concept of Judaism, and the Sadducees didn't believe in it. So therefore, there's no next world, no reward and punishment in the next world. And basically, it's fascinating to see that nothing has survived in writing from the Sadducees. We have no remnant of them today. Nothing. Except for little bits and pieces that were quoted by the Pharisees in our rabbinic literature. But basically nothing survives of them except for... They completely are gone. They're totally done. What we do have today that's fascinating is Cholent. Right? Has everybody had Cholent? Everybody know Cholent. Does everybody know what Cholent is? So Cholent is a Sabbath dish. Cholent is... Basically, Cholent can mean a mix-up of anything. I mean, as a word used in the colloquial thing, you could say, oh, my classroom is such a cholent of kids. I like, you know, it's all different ages and intelligence levels. So cholent can just mean a mishmash. But cholent, basically, it's an Ashkenazic recipe, is beans, barley, potatoes, meat, or bones, depending on
stew. How
much money you have. It's a stew, right? It's a stew that's put up before Shabbos and cooks all night. You eat it hot, Shabbos lunch.
Some people put whole eggs in it.
Some people, the Sephardim, put whole eggs in it. And different, so every, right, in the shell. Every Jewish group has a hot food that they serve the Sabbath day. If you're Yemenites, it's jachnun. It's a certain bread that cooks overnight. If you're Persian, well, there's a chamin, but there's also, I forgot what it's called, there's a yellow wheat berry and chicken thing that you serve with cinnamon on it. But all Jews all Sabbath observant Jews have a hot Sabbath day food that they serve. And this is because of the battle between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. It's because of that. So the Pharisees, the good guys, set up fences around Shabbos, how to protect Shabbos from intrusion. Like, for instance, you're not allowed to write on the Sabbath. In the beginning of Second Temple time, you were allowed to do business. You could use money on the Sabbath. Today, we don't use money on the Sabbath because of fences set up by the Pharisees who said, if you use money, if stores are open, you're likely going to come to write. Because if you sell something, you'll want to write it down for inventory purposes, and you might need to do math to make change, so you'll write. So in order to protect us from not writing, in order to protect Shabbos, we're going to say no money on Shabbos. Just makes it's hard to do business and have a Sabbath attitude also. So they've said no business, no money on the Sabbath, because you might come to writing, you might come to losing the Shabbos consciousness. And the Sadducees were totally against that. They were totally into no oral law, written law only. So written law in the Talmud, in the Torah, says no fires on the Sabbath. But the oral law says no kindling fires on the Sabbath, no tending fires on the Sabbath. But if you start a fire before the Sabbath, you can certainly benefit from it on the Sabbath. So we put up chulent before Shabbos, and we have it cook all night long so that we are using a fire on Shabbos to say, I accept the oral law and I reject the Sadducee interpretation that there means no fire in the place at all. And so it's an in-your-face food. It's a political food that we eat every Shabbos. It is. It's an acceptance of the oral law and the oral tradition and a rejection of the Sadducee view that there is no oral law that modifies the written law. So everybody has it. Chulent is from French. It could be from cholant, I think, which is slow and hot. But chalant, like nonchalant, means cool, right? So chalant is hot. Chulent, hot stuff on Shabbos, right? So even if you just leave up an urn, like let's say it's the summertime and you don't feel like eating hot on summer day. So even if you leave up an urn so you can have hot coffee or tea for breakfast, something that's hot overnight, that fulfills that. You want to have something hot on the Sabbath day that you prepared from before and kept hot the whole time just to make that statement. Okay. Now, hopefully, we're going to get to what I did not put on the front of your paper, but it's on the back of mine scribbled. Okay, so we left off with Shimon, the last of the Maccabees, is now the Kohen Gadol. Just quickly going through, he has a son, Yochanan. Yochanan, we said before that Shimon was very careful as the Kohen Gadol not to take on the kingship, which was very important because the king has to be from the line of David, and the Kohens are not. They're from the line of, David is from Judah, and Kohens are from Levi, right? So you can't be a Kohen Gadol and a king. It's not possible. It's two different brothers in the 12 tribes. So he was very careful, Shimon was careful as the Kohen Gadol not to take on the kingship, and yet there was the king position kind of open over the Jews that wasn't filled. His son, however, was not quite as careful, Yochanan. He took on the role of king, but not the title. He was careful not to take on the title, because he did understand this difference, but he did take on the role. So he didn't claim to be king, however, he acted as the king. One of the things he did as acting king, which was a bad thing for the Jews, was, I think it's the only time in history, a forced conversion. We Jews are not forcible converters. We don't believe in that. You have to want in. It's a difficult path to be a Jew. There's a lot of responsibility. We don't want anybody who's not interested in it. So we turn away converts. However, we do accept them, but they have to be willing to take on the whole package, and it's a big package. So there is no, you can't forcibly convert anybody to take on a heavy package of Judaism. But he did. So he forcibly converted the Edomites, which in a minute you'll hear why it was extra bad. Besides the fact that altogether that's just bad, we don't want to accept converts into Judaism because we are all one soul ultimately. We are one, and we can bring somebody in. They become attached to that one Jewish soul. We call it Klal Yisrael, the whole of Israel. So Klal Yisrael can be damaged by taking in somebody who becomes energy leak. The sages actually say that converts can be likened to a suppurating wound. on the body Israel. Very unpleasant vision, but just imagine a blochy, ugly, suppurating wound on a body. What an energy drain that is, right? You take systemic antibiotics for that. Your whole body needs to be protected from what that wound can do to your whole body, right? So a convert can be that. So I asked my rabbi about that when I first heard that. I was like, wait a second, that's not really a very nice image. And being a convert, I'd like to hear a little more about what that's talking about. He said, it's not talking about you. It's talking about somebody who converts according to halacha, according to Jewish law, and then leaves, which there do exist, those types, who convert according to Jewish law and then leave. They are, you can never unconvert. It's not possible to ever leave the Jewish people. Once you're Jewish, you're always Jewish forever and ever and ever, no matter what you do, no matter what you believe in. It's impossible to leave the Jewish people. So as my friend Miriam Fortune says, the door only swings one way. Swings one way. You can only go in. You cannot leave. So once you've gone in, if you choose to misbehave, then you create an energy drain on the body Israel. You create a place where the energy of Judaism and the energy of the Jews, the vitality of the Jews, exits through you if you don't behave in accordance with the Torah. So that it's talking that superating wound on the body Israel is referring to a convert that converts according to halacha and then leaves. So we certainly don't ever want to force anybody to convert because we don't want to cause that. We have enough with trying to gather in people who are born Jewish. We don't need to be bringing in problematic people from the outside. Yochanan, however, son of Shimon, the last Maccabee, did forcibly convert the Edomites. Yochanan had two sons, Alexander Yanai and Yehuda Aristobulus. Alexander Yanai, the younger one, was smart and wily and powerful and capable. Yehuda Aristobulus, the older one, soft-spoken, not so aggressive. He's the older one, so he gets to be the king, right? So he gets the position of his father when his father dies. So that is the king, really. Well, actually, wait, he's the, let's see. I have to get all this right together here. He's the child of, yeah. He is the child of Yochanan. Yochanan has these two kids, Yehuda Aristobulus. Yehuda Aristobulus marries Shlomtzion Hamalka. Shlomtzion, the queen. Yehuda, the name of her street. I'm not going to be able to tell you that much history because I don't know all that about this, but her street is in Jerusalem. You can see it, Shlomtzion Hamalka. She's a very fair and even-handed person. She marries Yehuda Aristobulus. It's a nice reign, but he doesn't last long. He hears through the grapevine that his brother is planning a coup. He gets sick, and so he puts his brother in jail because he's afraid that he's going to be poisoned. A lot of poisoning going on during this time. In the Roman times, poison is like all the rage. There's professional poisoners. A lot of people die of poisoning. It's a big deal. Food is a big deal at the time, and poisoning is a very easy way to kill people at the time. So he's nervous about being poisoned. He puts his brother in prison. Meanwhile, he's married to Shlomtzion Hamalka, whose brother is the head of the Prushim. Brother is the head of the Pharisees, and who's also the head of the Sanhedrin. His name is Shimon ben Shetach. He's a blood and guts guy. He fights for the Jews because he understands very clearly that if the Sadducees win and they get control over the Sanhedrin and control over the temple, they'll have control over Judaism, and Judaism will disappear because it's not actually Judaism. Those guys are Jews, but they teach not Judaism, and if they get control over the Jewish people, Judaism and Jews will disappear. So he fights very strongly for control of the Pharisees. Meanwhile, Yehuda Aristobulus dies, and his brother, his younger brother, claims the right of Yibum. Have you ever heard of Yibum, Levirate marriage? So this is how it works. A man is married to a woman. The man dies with no children. And now the brother is obligated to marry her and redeem his brother's energy that resides within her. So the first child that is born to younger brother and widow is called after the name of the deceased without children. And so that, because it's a whole interesting philosophic thing, when somebody marries, we have a concept of ishto kegufo, his wife is like his body. Because you get married and because you have sexual relations and because sexual relations bring the two bodies together and create one flesh, there is a concept that there is one body between the two people. And so even if half the body dies, the wife then still holds literally part of the genetic material of the husband because of the sexual relations, but also spiritually part of who he was is in her. And so she and the younger brother are the two people on the planet that can create a body that is the closest genetic match to the body that died without children. The body that died without children, the person that died without children, is considered, for whatever reason, to have been taken out of the world before he could damage himself further. That is a concept. Sometimes people, young, are taken before they can create further damage to themselves and their souls. So their soul then needs to be reincarnated. And souls and bodies are a perfect match. So a body is the right genetic match for that soul, that soul's best expression. Needs, if you think about your body and your soul needs your learning abilities, disabilities, your asthma, your diabetes, your flat feet, your glasses, your socioeconomic status, your ability to focus and not focus, and whatever it is, your soul needs that for its best expression. So that now that disembodied soul is, so to speak, wandering, needs a body to come into, so the widow and the younger brother can make the best body for that soul to come into. That's Yibum.
If there's no younger brother or other brother, do they extend the line to a cousin? Does it, as long as they can get a cousin?
They do. They do, but it's not required, but it is an option. And we see that in the Book of Ruth.
If the woman dies?
No.
Uh-uh.
It's about the woman and the younger. It's only if the man is childless that dies, and only that I think the I'm not sure of all the halachic ramifications, but it goes to the younger brothers. So you see that in the story of Yehuda and Tamar, right? Because Yehuda has three sons, and they all die. The first two die, and she's waiting now for the third son to grow up enough that she can marry him. But Yehuda, the father, doesn't want. She's buried already two of his sons. He doesn't want to marry her to the third one. But she knows prophetically that she needs to conceive from that seed line in order for Mashiach to be born. And so Tamar, this is all in chapter 34 in the book of Genesis. So Tamar dresses up as a harlot, seduces Yehuda, and gets his seed into her to conceive the child that needs to come out. And you see it in the book of Ruth also, where Ruth marries Mahlon, and Mahlon dies, and then also Kilion, the other brother, dies. That's married to Orpah. Orpah goes her way, but Ruth goes with Naomi, comes back to the land of Israel. She converts again. That's a whole different question and story. But then Boaz is her next in line. Well, he's actually the next in line redeemer. He's the one that marries her, which is why we know her name, his name. The next in line, his name is actually Tov, but we call him Plony, which is John Doe in Jewish. Plony chooses not to redeem her. And so we don't appreciate Plony. So he doesn't get his name mentioned. He's just Plony. And that becomes the John Doe. Whenever you talk about somebody that you don't know their name, you just say Plony, Plony Almoni. That's who they are.
Is there not a ritual where the brother may cast off in some fashion his responsibility?
Yes, there is. So, okay, now you have the widow, and she's looking at the younger brother thinking, ew, I don't want to marry him. Or you have younger brother who looks at the woman and says, I'm not doing that, right? So what do you do? They are married, really. I mean, just right away. They don't have to go through a wedding ceremony. But, so they do have to do some kind of separation ceremony if either one of them chooses not to be in that relationship. That separation ceremony, because of what I just explained to you, is actually not so good for the soul of the deceased, right? Not such a happy thing. Soul of deceased is hoping that they'll stay together. But they're human beings, and they get to pick if they want to be married or not. Nobody's obligated to get married in Judaism. So if either of them doesn't want it, there is a ceremony. The ceremony to stop it is called chalitza, where the woman, does she actually take off a shoe? He removes his shoe, and she spits in it. The shoe represents the body. The foot represents the soul. The body is like the shoe of the soul. The soul coming into this world is very vulnerable and so needs something to protect it, like our shoe, like our foot when we go outside. Our foot is vulnerable to all the things that are outside on the ground, all the prickly things. We put a shoe on it to protect it. So we put our our soul into a body to protect it. So removing the shoe is like saying, I take away the body from this soul. And it's not a nice thing to do, so I'm spitting in it to show, this is not nice. I don't know, maybe you can wash it out and wear it again, yeah.
Don't they throw the shoe away?
I don't know, I've never witnessed a full one. I did actually watch part of a chalitza ceremony on YouTube. It does happen once in a while. Still today, it occasionally happens that you have to do chalitza. It's not often, but if that happens, then you still have to legally, we don't do yibum anymore. There's not the automatic marriage. It's automatic chalitza. If the couple wants to date and get married again, they can, but we just do automatic chalitza these days. So, right. So anyway, back to our story. So turns out that Alexander Yanai, the younger brother, claims the rights and responsibility of Yibum with Shlom Tzion Hamalka, the sitting queen. Now, he's in prison, don't forget, because his brother thought was worried about him. So he goes from prison to the throne in one day. Right? So now he has been elevated. Okay? And he had the chutzpah to claim himself the king. Everybody else was tentative about it. They claimed the position, but not the title. He claims the title. So Alexander Yanai claims the title. He mints coins. And so he's in trouble. I mean, spiritually, he's in trouble because he did something he shouldn't be doing. He and Shlom Tzion have two sons, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus. When Alexander Yanai passes away, so these two are fighting now. Who's going to get to succeed, right? Because that's what sons do when their father dies. They make a huge mistake, and they go to Rome to ask for help. Please help us figure out what to do here. Please help us kick out the Greeks and help us figure out our story. And so in comes Pompey from Rome, and he helps out. He puts Hyrcanus on the throne, and he imprisons Aristobulus. But really who's in charge is a Roman lackey, who is an Edomite convert, and his name is Antipater. Antipater somehow gets the throne, and he is the father of Herod. Herod the Great and Terrible. We should call him Herod the Terrible, but he's called Herod the Great because he did create a great empire. He did a lot of building. The Second Temple Wall, the Kotel today, is Herodian building. The Cave of the Patriarchs has a whole building on it right now today. That's a Herodian building. There's a lot of Herodian buildings still left in Israel today, still standing today. So he was a huge builder. And he increased the size of the temple, right? I think he increased the whole, the western wall that's there today basically had a little hill. On this little hill is where Jacob had his dream and the 12 rocks come together, and that's where the temple is built. And so the temple can be built on this little hill right here. Very nice, very cute, too little for Herod, who wants a nice, big, showy temple. So what he does is he builds a wall like this all around the hill, and he backfills it. So to make a bigger platform. So it's the same hill, but a lot more space. And so the western wall that's there today is a retaining wall. It has nothing to do with the temple, except for it held the dirt that made the hill bigger that had the temple on top of it. So, and we have most of those retaining walls all around that space today, and the western wall is that, just a retaining wall. That was built by Herod. Herod understands he comes from questionable converts. So nobody really holds him Jewish because there were forced converts, right? So so he wants to legitimize his kingship. So he wants to marry the last of the Hasmonean females, the last of the Hasmonean dynasty. Right, so there's one female left, and he's going to marry her, but she says, nah, and she commits suicide. So he can't. So now all the Hasmoneans are gone. After 103 years of Hasmonean involvement, the Hasmoneans are completely gone. So even though they are the mastermind of the Hanukkah rededication, revolt, and the good things that happened because of the Hasmoneans, because they did assume the kingship, they're gone. So this happens in Judaism. So little bits and pieces happen, and they get wiped out along the way because we have one stream that manages to last through history. And there's lots of streams that depart from it, but they don't end up lasting. So this is what happens. So you have Herod. Herod rules under he begins his rule in 37 BCE. And remember we said that the Romans come in before that to help with the fight between Hyrcanus and Aristobulus. During Herod's rule, you have the famous Hillel and Shammai. So you have the oral law continuing to develop. We said that the end of the era of the prophets was the beginning of the Second Temple time. So you have really now a development of rabbinic law, and it's now in the hands of Hillel and Shammai. Hillel is considered the softer of the two. Shammai is considered the more stringent of the two. We rule according to the house of Hillel, which is why all our... And we have so many things named after Hillel, nothing named after Shammai. There's no Shammai campus house anywhere, right? It's all Hillel houses and Hillel academies or all the schools all around. Hillel is the guy. So I wish I could tell you a lot more about them, but I do want to get to the... Oh, my gosh. That's so not fair. Okay, maybe we won't do that. Oh, man. I really want to do my history thing. Should we just do that quick, or we can't do it that quick? I know, but I have this whole demonstration thing. It really helps get it all into... But it takes a little while. Oh, so quickly we'll do this, and then you just have to stay for an extra 10 minutes, and we'll do an hour demonstration in 10 minutes. So, okay, so you have Hillel and Shammai. Then fast forward very quickly, Philo the Apologist. He comes from Greece. He starts to talk a lot about Judaism, and he's an apologist for Judaism, and he starts to explain. He comes up with this concept of parable, and that Judaism is all about parables. And so, like, tefillin is about a parable. It's that the wearing the box should help you remember the fact that there's a God that did redeem you from Egypt, and he is involved in your life. But if you can remember that without the box, then you can remember that without the box. You don't need to put tefillin on. That kashrus is about purity of soul and purity of thought, but if you can be pure of soul and thought without the kashrus, then you don't need it, right? So he tried to figure out a whole parable system, kind of what other streams of Judaism did along the way, but he started with this. So he tried to blend Judaism because there was, I'm just trying to think, should I get to this or should I explain more of that? I guess we'll have to skip this and really, because we want to talk about rise of Christianity and seeds of that. It's very important to understand that the seeds of Christianity were being planted actually much earlier as the Greeks realized that their philosophy was, the philosophy of all the many gods was foolish. But they looked at Judaism, the only monotheistic version of the world, you know, of anything in the world, and has all these mitzvahs attached to it. Very difficult to be monotheistic and get a circumcision and keep kosher and keep Shabbos and bring temple offerings and dress in a certain way and. That's a lot of work. So people were not so interested in it. So Philo really helped, his Hebrew name is Chaim, he really helped with the transition. He didn't really know it yet, but he really helped with the transition from Judaism with all its mitzvahs to Christianity without. But he wasn't actually acting as a bridge, but he was a bridge in the end, because his philosophy reduced Judaism into parables. So that just kind of, he talked about the essence of the thing rather than the actual thing. We Jews are about the actual thing. You got to put on tefillin. Believe in God or not, tefillin go on every day, except Shabbos. So we do the thing, and we wonder about it after. But that's what we said at Mount Sinai when God said, do you want the Torah? We said, we will do, and we will listen. Sure, we'll do it. Now tell me what it is. That's what you say when somebody close to you that you trust says, can you do me a favor? You say, sure. What? Right? Somebody you don't know that you don't trust, you say, what? First, before you answer yes or no. Right? But somebody that you trust, and they say, can you do me a favor? You say, sure. What? So we trusted God, and God said, do you want the Torah? We said, sure. What is it? So that's not as they've nishma. We will do and we will hear. So as Jews, we do, and then we try to understand, which is the opposite kind of today. As Jews are coming back, we want to understand first before we decide if we're going to do. But really, the Jewish pathway is do, and then you come to understanding. So, of course, Philo's apologies ran counter to that. But meanwhile, you have people who are trying to figure out how to integrate monotheism, how to integrate dealing with the difficulty of the Roman occupation. The Romans were really tough, so you have the Essenes. Now, in listening to Beryl Wine, and not being an expert in history, but having lived through the last 30 years and his tapes being made in 1985, I know that the philosophy or the theories have changed on the Essenes since he spoke on that tape. So he's talked about how they were the early Christians. I know that today there's not clarity if they were the early Christians or not. But certainly the Essenes, the Dead Sea Scroll people, and that's even not clarity if they were the Dead Sea Scroll people or not today. We're not really sure. But they certainly were an ascetic group, and a monotheistic group, and they were trying to figure out how to deal with Judaism and mitzvahs, and should they do, shouldn't they do. They didn't, since they were ascetic and they were and celibate, they relied on conversion, much like the Shakers, you know, who there's only, I don't know, a few Shakers left today. Pardon? None? No Shakers left? They all died now? So, right, so they couldn't be replaced by birth. They had to only be replaced by conversion. Anyway, but early Christianity did start to develop. However, it did start to develop. So it was, there was a desire for monotheism light, for Judaism light, for Judaism without all the work. They wanted a connection with the one God. And at the same time, the Roman oppression made it very difficult. We Jews have a Messiah concept. The Messiah concept is, when times are bad, times will get better. And somebody's going to make that happen. They have to be really bad, and it's going to get really better. There is a lot. I've put a bunch of stuff here on the bottom of the sheet for more Messiah conversation. Just I took some stuff out of a Ken Spiro at H.com article. So you can have some Jewish sources here and some stuff that that's listed in Maimonides, just so you can see some more Messiah stuff, but it's not a class on the Messiah. But basically, it was a difficult time of oppression. They were waiting for the Messiah. So there were a lot of false messiahs at the time. Watch Life of Brian. You'll see what it was actually like at the time. Or not. that's a Monty Python movie. And so there were a lot of false messiahs arising because it was a difficult time for the Jews. And so one of them was Jesus. Now, the Talmud has been excised, basically, of all mention of Jesus. So we don't actually know very much from Jewish sources, and even from Josephus, which was censored by the Christians, because he's our other main historical person who lived at the time. And so we don't even know so much from Josephus. However, the Talmud has two opinions. Basically, it believes that he did exist. But it's possible that Justice says that maybe he was a parable, right? Because he brought this whole parable view of Judaism into the world, or at least on his wings that was brought into the world. So the Talmud also is wondering if possibly he's a parable for a person and didn't actually exist. But I think in general, the Talmud does. The excised parts have been rediscovered, and it is pretty clear that he existed, and that he did create... It was on his back that this church was created. Really, it was Peter, who was closer to Judaism than Paul, who was the great publicist. But Peter started a Jewish sect that was the early Christian sect. And as people started to step away from Judaism, he actually, according to the Talmud, left it, did tshuva, came back to Judaism, but left it kind of in the hands of Paul, who was a great publicist, and he really brought it into a non-Jewish religion and opened it up to the Gentiles and made it in a whole different ball of wax, so that it was a completely different thing. The rabbis at the time, not happy with this development, because it was initially Jewish. And so they said very clearly, you're not Jewish, and anything that comes from you is not Jewish. The Essenes aren't Jewish, the Christians aren't Jewish, and all these little other sects that are happening here, with all these false messiahs, not Jewish. And in fact, to our prayer of 18 blessings, we are now going to add a 19th to say, you're not Jewish, and we reject you. And that's the blessing of La Malshinim. To the cult, we reject, basically, is what it is. And you can see it in the weekday Amidah prayer, which is called the Shemona Esrei, the 18, but really it has 19 blessings. So remember we said that the prayers were fixed by the Anshei Knesset HaGadolah, the men of the Great Assembly, which were the beginning of the Second Temple. This is the end of the Second Temple, but that 19th was added, but it was already called the 18. So we still call it the 18, but it's 19 blessings. And there's an anti-Christian blessing in it. It doesn't mention Christians, but it just says, all those cults, not a part of us, please keep them away, and please help them not destroy us in their philosophies. And that's all we get. So, sorry, and I would love to do, maybe next time I'll just ask him, because I have such a nice history review that shows the whole thing from creation until now. But you have to kind of walk the path with the pictures and the rope and everything so you can see it. Also, I'll ask Rabbi Wasserman if afterwards we could take one class from the next one so we could do that, just to put it all in order, because it really helps to be able to see the whole thing start to finish. So you should have a wonderful, happy, kosher Pesach. Enjoy it. Pesach, just as you're leaving, everybody leave, but just listen as you're leaving. Pesach means Passover, skip over. So part of the passing over is being able to pass over steps that you need to put into place. You can pass over spiritual steps and accomplish a lot of stuff, Pesach time. So seize the energy and decide what you want to pass over and what you want to accomplish. That's the essence of the holiday. Passing over basic steps, achieving a lot.
Two things. First of all, what did you tell me about...